I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
Any involvement of a foreign government in the killing of a Canadian citizen on Canadian soil is an unacceptable violation of our sovereignty. It is contrary to the fundamental rules by which free, open, and democratic societies conduct themselves.
Tension is escalating between Canada and India after Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau accused agents of the Indian government of assassinating a prominent Canadian Sikh leader outside a temple in British Columbia in June. We'll get the latest. Then to the case of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange as calls grow for the Biden administration to halt its prosecution of the imprisoned journalist. We'll speak to Gustavo Petro, the president of Colombia, who called on the U.S. to free Assange.
And Biden could launch the message of democracy, lifting up the process. He could pardon him, what have you. The path to tell the world that a journalist doing their job as a journalist should not be kept prisoner, even if it has a negative impact on the interests of U.S. power.
We'll also hear from the Brazilian President Lula. And we'll speak to an Australian senator who's just flown into Washington, D.C. as part of a delegation to lobby the U.S. to abandon its plan to extradite Julian Assange from Britain. Then to Indigenous leader Winona LaDuke, a judge in Minnesota, has thrown out criminal charges against her and two other water defenders who were arrested for protesting at the construction site of Enbridge's Line 3 pipeline.
It has been heartbreaking for us to undergo this trauma of all of these years of facing this corporation, and to have the judge say that to criminalize us further would be a crime. That was caused us all to kind of cry. You know, because we're not criminals. We're women who want clean water.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Authorities in Nagorno-Karabakh say they've accepted a Russian-proposed ceasefire one day after Azerbaijan launched a military operation in the contested territory. Peace talks between Azerbaijan and Armenia are scheduled to start Thursday. Yesterday's attack reportedly killed close to 100 people and injured hundreds more. Tensions have been growing in Nagorno-Karabakh in recent months as Azerbaijani forces sealed off its only road linking it to Armenia, leading to major food, fuel, on medical shortages, as well as accusations of genocide. Nagorno-Karabakh is overwhelmingly populated by ethnic Armenians, but is recognized as Azerbaijani territory as part of a Russia-brokered ceasefire following the 2020 war. Protesters gathered in Armenia's capital, Yerevan, on Tuesday.
I hope that finally they can find any solution to this problem, solution that can satisfy both sides, and we can live peacefully. That's my opinion. I know it's difficult. It cannot be a decision which will satisfy both sides, but we should come to that. Otherwise, it will continue and hundreds, thousands of innocent people will die.
During the protests, police used stun grenades to disperse crowds trying to enter a government building. Israeli forces killed 19-year-old Palestinian Durran al-Ahras during a raid near Jericho in the occupied West Bank earlier today. His grieving father decried his killing.
He is an unarmed citizen, a child. He has nothing to do with all this. Durran is an unarmed person. He is a civilian. Whoever walks the street should be shot just because he is one of our people.
One day earlier on Tuesday, Israeli soldiers killed another four Palestinians, including three in the occupied West Bank, in a raid on the Jenin refugee camp with 20 others injured. Separately in the Gaza Strip, 25-year-old Yusuf Salam Radwan was shot dead by Israeli soldiers. On Sunday, Israel said it's keeping the Beit Hanun crossing closed as it violently cracks down on Palestinian protests. Beit Hanun is the only operational crossing for Gazans to enter Israel, including some 18,000 Palestinians who work in Israel. This comes as President Biden's meeting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly here in New York. The Biden administration's criticized the gutting of the judiciary by Netanyahu's far-right coalition government and its plans to expand illegal settlements, though it has not pulled back its $3.8 billion in annual military funding to Israel. The U.S. is also pushing a deal to fully normalize relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia. The New York Times reports the Biden administration's in talks with Saudi Arabia over a mutual defense treaty that would resemble military pacts the U.S. has with Japan and South Korea. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is reportedly also seeking U.S. help to develop a civilian nuclear program. While campaigning for president, Biden vowed to make MBS a pariah over the assassination of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi and other human rights issues. In related news, Houthi negotiators and Saudi officials wrapped up 5 days of talks in Riyadh on a possible path to ending the war in Yemen. The Saudi-led, U.S.-backed conflict has killed hundreds of thousands of people since 2015, with 80% of Yemen's population relying on humanitarian aid. Here in New York, world leaders continue to address the UN General Assembly. The addresses began yesterday. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky warned Russia's invasion poses a threat to all nations.
And it is a clear Russia's attempt to weaponize the food shortage on the global market in exchange for recognition for some, if not all, of the captured territories. Russia is launching the food prices as weapons. The impact spans from the Atlantic coast of Africa to the Southeast Asia, and this is the threat scale.
President Biden expressed ongoing support for Ukraine and condemned Russia's naked aggression. In his speech, Biden also called for global climate action, global AI, artificial intelligence regulations, managing competition with China, and urged the UN to back a security support mission to Haiti, as he called it, where gang violence has been surging. One day after a high-profile Iran-U.S. prisoner swap, the Iranian president, Ibrahim Raisi, told the U.N. General Assembly the U.S., quote, project to Americanize the world has failed, as he hailed a new world order. He also called on the U.S. to revive the Iran nuclear deal President Trump pulled the U.S. out of.
America should demonstrate its goodwill and genuine willingness to fulfill its commitments and conclude the path.
Outside the UN headquarters, protesters gathered to condemn Iran's crackdown on dissent and protest just after the first anniversary of the killing of Mahsa Amini. Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel called for major reforms to international economic institutions and national debts that have overwhelmingly harmed countries in the global south. Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva also addressed the UN.
We will continue to criticize any attempt to divide the world into zones of influence and to reissue the Cold War. The UN Security Council is progressively losing its credibility. This fragility stems in particular from the actions of its permanent members who wage unauthorized wars in pursuit of territorial expansion or government change.
Lula's comments echoed calls for a change to the international order at this weekend's G77 summit as low- and middle-income countries met in Havana, Cuba. Among those addressing the G77 was Honduran President Xiomara Castro.
We are not pieces in a board that promotes dependency. Our nations must not keep on suffering the massive privatization of their territories.
In Washington, D.C., House Republicans remain mired in turmoil as infighting and threats by the far right push the government closer to an October 1st shutdown. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy delayed a key procedural vote Tuesday on a 30-day stopgap spending bill after opposition from members of the Freedom Caucus. Hours later, that hardline Freedom Caucus also blocked debate on a Pentagon spending bill and another blow to McCarthy. Meanwhile, House Democrats and some less extreme Republicans could work together to garner enough support for a spending bill that would bypass McCarthy and the far right's demand for massive spending cuts. In Pennsylvania, Democratic Governor Josh Shapiro announced Tuesday, Pennsylvania will now automatically register eligible voters when they obtain or renew driver's licenses or ID cards.
We'll save taxpayers time and money, reduce the number of costly paper registrations, and streamline voter registration for Pennsylvanians. Look, this is common sense. You already provide proof of identity, residency, age, and citizenship at the DMV. All the information you need to register to vote.
Pennsylvania joins 23 mostly Democratic states in Washington, D.C., in having some form of automatic voter registration. Meanwhile, Democrat Lindsey Powell easily won a special election Tuesday in Pittsburgh, restoring the Democrats' one-seat majority in the Pennsylvania House. She's the first Black woman to represent the predominantly white 21st district in Allegheny County. West Point's being sued over the military academy's race-based admissions policies. The lawsuit is spearheaded by the same anti-affirmative action group that sued Harvard and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The conservative Students for Fair Admissions won that landmark case before the U.S. Supreme Court in June, gutting race-conscious admissions policies at colleges and universities nationwide. But the ruling excluded military academies. And at least 20 indigenous leaders and climate activists were arrested Tuesday as actions demanding an end to fossil fuels continued during New York's Climate Week. Dozens of protesters swarmed the Bank of America Tower in Manhattan yesterday, blocking entrances as they chanted, "We need clean air, not another billionaire." The bank is one of the largest funders of oil, gas, and coal across the globe, as well as the leading financial backer of the contested Mountain Valley Pipeline. This is environmental activist John Beard of the Port Authority Community Action Network in Texas.
We refuse to be sacrificed any further on the altar of big oil, big gas, and big finance and BOA. We refuse to allow them to put profits over people and determine the lives and future of people in the Gulf South without them having any benefit from it and destroying the very planet upon which we all depend.
That's environmental activist John Beard of the Port Arthur Community Action Network in Texas. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Tension is escalating between Canada and India after Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau publicly accused agents of the Indian government of assassinating a prominent Canadian Sikh leader outside a temple in the city of Surrey in British Columbia in June. Hardeep Singh Nijjar, who was a Canadian citizen, was shot dead by two masked gunmen who escaped in a waiting car. In an address to the Canadian Parliament Monday, Trudeau accused India of orchestrating the assassination.
Any involvement of a foreign government in the killing of a Canadian citizen on Canadian soil is an unacceptable violation of our sovereignty. It is contrary to the fundamental rules by which free, open, and democratic societies conduct themselves.
Hardeep Singh Nijjar was a prominent leader in the Khalistan movement, a Sikh separatist movement which advocates for the formation of an independent Sikh homeland in the northwest Indian state of Punjab. India's government, which is led by the hardline Hindu nationalist Narendra Modi, had designated Nijjar as a terrorist, claiming he was the leader of a militant group. While the Indian government's denied involvement in his murder, India's long been accused of targeting Sikh leaders at home and abroad. Hardeep Singh Nijjar's son, Balraj Nijjar, spoke on Tuesday.
It was just a matter of time for when the truth would come out. So when we heard that news today, it was a sense of relief that, you know, it's finally coming to the public eyes that, you know, the Indian government is involved.
The assassination was also condemned by Mukhbir Singh of the World Sikh Organization of Canada.
You know, the younger generation that grew up in Canada, they grew up hearing stories about the persecution, about the fear of speaking out a little too much and you might get on a list or be targeted. And so to see that happening right now in 2023 in Canada, you know, it certainly is shocking. And I hope the larger community sees that and understands how truly shocking this is to see a Canadian attacked on Canadian soil by a foreign country. I think we can't understate how shocking that news is.
On Monday, Canada expelled India's top intelligence official in Canada. In response, India expelled a senior Canadian diplomat. We're joined now by Arjun Singh Sethi. He is a human rights lawyer and adjunct professor at Georgetown Law. He is a member of the Sikh community. We welcome you to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us under very terrible circumstances. Can you explain what happened in June, the assassination of Arjun Singh Sethi, and then how this all became public with the Prime Minister of Canada denouncing India and apparently having these meetings with Narendra Modi and President Biden at the G20 summit in India?
Thank you so much for having me on the show. In June, Hardeep Singh Nijjar was leaving a Gurdwara, a Sikh house of worship, when he was violently gunned down under very mysterious, suspicious circumstances. Some in the Canadian Sikh community had long suspected that the Indian government was responsible. Fast forward several months, really to this week, and we hear from Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on the floor of the Canadian Parliament alleging that the Indian government orchestrated the assassination of a Canadian Sikh citizen in cold blood on account of protected political speech. And so Sikhs across Canada, the United States, and the world who are engaged in protected speech are concerned. And so are others. We've seen this administration, the Modi regime, target Muslims, Dalits, Sikhs, Christians. And so this is a warning to anyone engaged in activism, anyone engaged in speech, that you could be next.
And the Modi government has claimed now for years that Nijjar was a terrorist. Can you explain the basis of these allegations by the Modi government and what his activism was about?
Sure. So Mr. Nijjar came to Canada in the 90s. He later became a Canadian citizen. And as you know, that is a vetted process. And so clearly the Canadian government determined he wasn't a threat. And then in 2020, when the Indian government labeled him a terrorist, they did so under the UAPA, the Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, which human rights bodies have routinely called draconian, regressive, and other things, because it allows the Indian government to label someone a terrorist without due process and without trial. And so we've seen the Indian government use that law to imprison Stan Swamy, a Jesuit priest, Umar Khalid, a longtime Muslim activist, Kurram Pervez, a Kashmiri journalist. And it's this same law that the Indian government used to target Mr. Nijjar. Again, it's draconian. And part of the outcome of this investigation and process is that this law should be denounced and really abandoned by the Indian government, because, again, human rights bodies have called for that for a long time.
And could you talk about some of the persecution that has been occurring under the Modi government against minorities within India, especially of the Sikhs?
Sure. I mean, let's go back. You know, as the chief minister of Gujarat in 2002, Modi authorized and enabled the Gujarat program, in which thousands of Muslims died. It was on account of that he was banned from entering the United States for more than 10 years. And so he was treated as a pariah because of his role in the 2002 Gujarat program. As prime minister, we've seen countless human rights violations. We saw the Indian government roll back the autonomy of Kashmir and commit human rights atrocities there. We've seen India lead the world in internet blackouts. We've seen the Modi administration push forward the Citizenship Amendment Act, the National Registry of Citizens, which are mechanisms really to just strip Muslims and others of citizenship. Hate violence in India today, specifically targeting Muslims and Dalits, is so commonplace that sometimes it's organized online and the videos uploaded for the world to see. Just recently, and in a terrible mistake, President Biden celebrated Modi with a state dinner, and the United States Congress welcomed him with a joint address. Meanwhile, hundreds of churches were burning in Manipur, and we didn't hear anything from Prime Minister Modi.
Arjun Singh Sethi, if you can talk about threats to the Sikh community worldwide, it's sort of on a model of Russians who have been poisoned in different countries outside of Russia, or Operation Condor decades ago outside of Chile, but organized by the Chilean government. Can you talk about what Sikhs face? And is this assassination unusual?
So let me sort of go back for a second and provide a deeper context. And that context really goes back to the 1980s. In the wake of the assassination of Indira Gandhi, thousands of Sikhs were murdered in pogroms in Delhi and across India. Those Sikhs and those families are still awaiting justice decades later. In the years that followed, thousands of Sikhs were murdered across Punjab and enforcibly disappeared by the Indian government. There's a wonderful human rights organization that documents this work called NSOF in the United States, and I encourage everyone to check it out. And so Sikhs who have engaged in activism in India have long been targeted. And we've also seen that Sikhs in the diaspora who engage in activism face a variety of consequences. In some cases, Sikhs are prohibited from entering India. In some cases, the Indian government refuses to grant them visas. In some cases, their social media feeds are blocked on X and other platforms. And as you point out, we've long suspected that the Indian government has been behind targeted assassinations in other countries as well. What makes this story particularly unique is that it's the Canadian government. And it shows just how emboldened the Modi administration is. And this is what happens when the world decides to embrace an authoritarian leader like Narendra Modi. Narendra Modi should be uttered in the same breath as Putin, as Mohammed bin Salman. But when you give him a pass, when you empower and embolden him, he brings terror to a neighborhood near you. And that's what we're seeing in Canada today.
On Tuesday, World Sikh Organization of Canada President Mukhbir Singh and the National Council of Canadian Muslims CEO Stephen Brown held a news conference at the House of Commons in Ottawa, Canada. This is Brown speaking about the threats the RSS Hindu nationalist movement poses to both the Muslim and Sikh communities.
Members of the Muslim community and the Sikh community and many other communities have been complaining for years that they have been targeted by harassment and threats by individuals and associations affiliated with the RSS. And for years, we've been talking to this about this topic to the Canadian government, and nothing has been done, which is why we are asking right now for the Canadian government to ban the RSS from Canada and expulse its agents from the country.
And so talk about what you see happening now in Canada with this all becoming so public. Of course, so was the assassination in June. But with the throwing out of the top Indian intelligence official and then India retaliating, throwing out a Canadian official, where you see this heading right now? Also extremely inconvenient for President Biden, who is trying to improve relations with Narendra Modi at this point as he sets up new alliances.
So I live in the United States. Sikhs represent, I believe, almost 2% of the Canadian population. The Canadian government over the years has welcomed Sikhs who have been persecuted in India. And so I would absolutely defer to them. Having said that, you are seeing Sikhs protest, speak out, organize, because, again, a Sikh activist who ran a plumbing business, who was a pillar of Sikh society in Vancouver, was murdered in cold blood. And so it is but to be expected that they are fearful, and they want answers. The Indian government, I believe last night, summarily dismissed the claims, and Prime Minister Trudeau doubled down and asked, again, for the Modi administration to cooperate. And the Biden administration has said so as well. And so next steps include bringing the individuals who executed Mr. Nijjar to account, a comprehensive investigation that documents who approved this targeted assassination, and a deeper conversation really about the fact that India is not the world's largest democracy. India is the world's largest authoritarian regime.
And in terms of the position of the Canadian Prime Minister, Trudeau has not exactly been a profile in courage in terms of differing with the United States when it comes to policy around the world. Do you expect that this this strong stand of Trudeau is going to have an impact on the United States as well?
I hope so. You know, as I already mentioned, you know, the Biden administration has somehow taken the approach that it is sufficient to have private conversations with the Modi regime, and that somehow that will nudge the Modi regime to be more respectful of human rights. But in fact, it's the opposite. When we roll the red carpet out for Prime Minister Modi, at the same time that he is perpetrating human rights atrocities, it emboldens him further. And so I do hope the Biden administration pays close attention. I do hope the Biden administration realizes that the time for private engagement is over. The world needs to come together and ask difficult questions of the Modi regime, questions that really should have been posed a long time ago. Again, you know, Narendra Modi showed the world who he was a long time ago, and it's time that we listened.
Arjun Singh Sethi, we thank you so much for being with us, human rights lawyer, adjunct professor at Georgetown Law School, member of the Sikh community, speaking to us from Nashville, Tennessee. Next up, we look at the growing calls for the Biden administration to drop charges against the imprisoned publisher Julian Assange. We'll hear from the Brazilian President Lula and play a clip of our exclusive interview with the Colombian President Gustavo Petro. And we'll talk to an Australian senator who's just flown into Washington, D.C., as part of a delegation to lobby the U.S. to abandon its plan to extradite Julian Assange from Britain. Stay with us.
Ram Bhagat Chitlaya Gurmukh Ram Naam Jap Hirday Sahaj Sethi Kar Jaya Man Re Ram
Sikh devotional musician Bhayavtar Singh. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The United Nations General Assembly opened Tuesday here in New York. The Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva was the first world leader to speak. He called for urgent action to address the climate crisis and to combat growing inequality. He also voiced support for Julian Assange, the imprisoned founder of WikiLeaks.
Preserving press freedom is essential. A journalist like Julian Assange cannot be punished for informing society in a transparent and legitimate way.